Welcome to the audio edition of the Bylines Network. In here, you'll find four articles from different publications in the network, read by our team of readers. Thank you to our writers for writing them, and to our readers for recording them. We hope you enjoy.
The Northeast on screen. Get Carter, 1971. By Phil Coghill. Read by Stephen Tomlin. The Northeast on Screen is a new series of articles that will look at films and TV programmes made or set in the northeast of England. For our first article, we will be looking at possibly the most famous, the 1971 crime classic, Get Carter. Based on the novel Jack's Return Home by Ted Lewis, Get Carter follows London gangster Jack Carter, Michael Caine, as he returns to his hometown to seek revenge for his brother's death. It's a plot right out of a classic film noir that could have easily been made in Hollywood 30 years earlier, starring Humphrey Bogart or Alan Ladd. The book was set in an unspecified northern town, so screenwriter-director Mike Hodges decided to film in an area he was familiar with, ultimately choosing to film in Newcastle and Gateshead. This works in the film's favour, as the bleak-looking Tyneside of the early 70s adds to the gritty tone. The most memorable location was the car park in Gateshead's Trinity Square, which later became known as the Get Carter car park. Sadly, despite calls for it to be preserved as a cinematic landmark, it was demolished in 2010. At first glance, Michael Caine appears to be miscast. The actor was at the time best known for playing lovable rogues, the complete antithesis of Carter. While the character may have an understandable motivation, Carter is completely unlikable, cold-blooded, and not that much better than the villains he's going up against. And yet, not only is Caine completely convincing, but it's also impossible to picture anyone else in the role. Even Caine foregoing using a Geordie accent works, as it makes sense for a character who has clear disdain for where he grew up, referring to it as a crap house at one point, and has lived down south for many years, to have deliberately lost his accent over time. Caine's co-stars also give strong performances. Ian Hendry was originally slated to play Carter, but cast as henchman Eric Pace instead, due to his alcoholism, and his resulting animosity towards Caine gives their scenes together an extra amount of tension. The writer John Osborne, famous for his plays about angry young men, is a left-field choice to play main villain Kinnear, but like Caine, ends up fitting perfectly, and brings a sense of quiet menace. While a hit with British audiences, critical reviews condemned the film for its violent content. By contrast, American critics were much more positive, but due to distributor MGM putting more focus on the now mostly forgotten blaxploitation remake Hitman, 1972, it was not given a wide release in the States. By the 90s, however, the film had developed a strong cult following on both sides of the Atlantic, and is now considered to be one of the best films made in Great Britain. Another US remake, this time starring Sylvester Stallone as a much more likeable and sympathetic Carter, followed in 2000, but flopped at the box office and was panned by critics and fans alike. As we live in an age where studios try to coast on the success of pre-existing properties, it's perhaps inevitable that Get Carter will be remade again at some point. But as the previous attempts have shown, it will be doomed to failure, as nothing will beat the original in the eyes of the public.
Will the Commonwealth Games be good for Birmingham? By Sam Chandler. Last week, the Queen started the relay race that will eventually culminate at the opening ceremony of the 2022 Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. At the same time, Birmingham Perry Bar MP, Khalid Mahmood, was objecting to the isolation of residents from discussions, claiming that there had been a lack of consultation on key issues, particularly transport. This comes mere months after the end of the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Discourse around the Games has often focused on the costs that are incurred by the host city. The Games frequently go over budget, and local communities are destroyed to make way for the Games. The economic benefits from the event themselves are often minimal, as other tourists are more hesitant to visit these cities during the Olympics. And the grand stadiums built for the Games frequently go unused or underused after their conclusion. Mahmoud's comments highlighted a similar concern about the Commonwealth Games. Already, local infrastructure, such as the A34 flyover in Perry Bar, is being destroyed to make way for new construction, despite protests. The council will be on the hook for paying £218 million towards the Games, despite being forced to cut 1,100 jobs in 2019, and even as services are being reduced, and council tax is being raised to the maximum threshold of 4.99%. At this time, it is important to ask, will the benefits of the Commonwealth Games be worth the costs? The main problem with the Summer Olympics is the cost of building facilities. Most host cities do not have the existing capacity for the Games, and so a significant effort has to go into building new stadiums, hotels, and training facilities. While host cities bear the main cost for building these facilities, it is the International Olympic Committee, IOC, that makes the profits from marketing around these Games, in addition to taking a cut of ticket and merchandise revenue. The Commonwealth Games Federation, CGF, which organises the Games, is not structured in the same way as the IOC. It has directors from across the Commonwealth, is headquartered in London, and receives heavy scrutiny from its patrons, the royal family. Being tied to the royals, it is thus associated closely with the institution of the Commonwealth and the political oversight which that entails. Meanwhile, the Games are also a lot cheaper. Whereas the 2012 London Olympics cost £9 billion, the Commonwealth Games are only scheduled to cost £778 million, despite budget increases. Generally, recent Games have seen a significant boost to the local economy in their aftermath. Analysis of the 2018 Commonwealth Games in Australia saw a net benefit to the region of £346 million, while the 2014 Games in Glasgow saw a benefit of £740 million over the 8 years from winning the bid to the Games' completion. There is, however, reason to be sceptical. Of course, it is in the interests of both the Games organisers and host cities to boast of the economic benefit of the Games. Meanwhile, academic research has shown that the CGF has a structural advantage over host cities in negotiations, and several papers go into detail about the need to broaden analysis of the impact of the Games beyond simple terms of revenue gained and lost. We should certainly approach the Games with a degree of optimism. The Commonwealth Games do not have the same problems as the Olympics, particularly in a city like Birmingham, which already has ample sporting infrastructure. But the voices of residents should be included in discussion, as they will be the ones most affected by the Games, and the ones who will have to deal with the consequences once the cameras are gone.
Who Will Police the Police? Written by Allegra Chapman, read by Nicola Tipton. On Thursday, Sarah Everard's murderer was sentenced to whole life in prison. A serving Metropolitan Police officer at the time, he used his position of power to falsely arrest Sarah and then raped, tortured, and murdered her. This sentencing happened on the same day that another man appeared in court charged with the brutal murder of Sabina Nessa. It also happened just days after the anniversary of the death of Blessing Olsugen, found dead in Bexhill in September 2020. Sussex police have been criticised for dismissing her mysterious drowning as not suspicious. It comes as campaigners are still awaiting justice for B-Bar Henry and Nicole Smallman, the murdered sisters of whose bodies police officers took inappropriate pictures that they then shared on WhatsApp. And it was yet another murder where the police were criticised for being slow to investigate. So far this year, over 100 women have been killed in the UK at the hands of men. Thursday was also the day that Kate Wilson won her tribunal against the undercover police officer who tricked her into having a sexual relationship with him for 2 years when he was investigating her campaign's group environmental activism. The married police officer may have had deceptive sexual relationships with as many as 10 other women during this time. Let's be clear about this. These are all acts of rape. Can women trust the police? So far this year, over 100 women have been killed in the UK at the hands of men. And those are just the ones we know about. Against this backdrop of senseless acts of violence against women, and where so many members of the police force are found to be either responsible or reprehensible, how are women supposed to feel safe on our streets? If the very people whose primary job is to protect us are instead disregarding or mocking or killing us, what protection is there? Can women trust the police? And perhaps, more importantly, should we? Abuse of power. In London, 160 Met police officers have been charged with sexual misconduct in the last 2 years. The force has been found to be institutionally racist in a damning report issued over 2 decades ago. And a recent investigative report by Byline Times found that half of the Metropolitan Police officers found guilty of sexual misconduct over a 4-year period to 2020 remained in their jobs. Lord Paddick, a former Deputy Assistant Commissioner, has said there is widespread sexism in the Metropolitan Police, but little, if anything, has been done. So what are the police doing to ensure that these so-called bad apples aren't able to abuse their power? How are they being held to account? And by whom? It has been discovered that Sarah Everard's murderer was not only nicknamed the rapist by colleagues, but had been reported just 2 days earlier for indecent exposure. He was also in a WhatsApp group with other serving and former police officers from a variety of forces, where they shared discriminatory and misogynistic messages which were grossly offensive or of an indecent, obscene or menacing character. No action has yet been taken against any of these officers, and it has been decided that investigating the involvement of the murderer himself would not further the interests of justice. Any lessons that can be learned from this, then, are likely to be limited. But it must haunt Sarah's loved ones to realise that, had any of these officers reported this behaviour, she might still be alive today. So what steps are the police, our local councils and our wider community doing to stop systemic attitudes of misogyny that lead to violence? It's hard to know, since Sussex Police and the county councils didn't want to talk to me. This is a systematic problem and it needs systematic solutions, says Kahina Buhasane. Too often the focus is on how women should manage their behaviour to avoid harassment. Personally, I'm sick of it. There is too little focus where it should be on challenging male perpetrators and the culture of toxic masculinity that promotes and enables street harassment. It is not all men, but it is all women that suffer as a result. Hopefully, Sussex Police and our town, district and county councils will now be looking at meaningful measures to protect women, educate men, and prevent institutional misconduct. But we're yet to see any indication that such urgently needed plans are in the works.